Chapter 10, the last chapter. In the name of the best within us. Dagny walked straight toward the guard who stood at the door of Project F. Her step sounded purposeful, even and open, ringing in the silence of the path among the trees. She raised her head to a ray of moonlight to let him recognize her face. "Let me in," she said.
"No admittance," he answered in the voice of a robot. "By order of Dr. Ferris."
"I am here by order of Mr. Thompson."
"Uh-huh. I don't know about that."
"I do.
I mean, Dr. Ferris hasn't told me, ma'am."
"I am telling you."
"But I'm not supposed to take any orders from anyone excepting Dr. Ferris."
"Do you wish to disobey Mr. Thompson?"
"Oh, no, ma'am, but if Dr. Ferris said to let nobody in, that means nobody."
He added uncertainly and pleadingly,
"Doesn't it?
Do you know that I'm Dagny Taggart, and that you've seen my pictures in the papers with Mr. Thompson and all the top leaders of the country?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Then decide whether you wish to disobey their orders."
"Oh, no, ma'am, I don't."
"Then let me in."
"But I can't disobey Dr. Ferris either."
"Then choose."
"But I can't choose, ma'am." "Who am I to choose?"
"You'll have to."
"Look," he said hastily, pulling a key from his pocket and turning to the door. "I'll ask the chief."
"He—" "No," she said. Some quality in the tone of her voice made him whirl back to her. She was holding a gun pointed levelly at his heart. "Listen carefully," she said. "Either you let me in or I shoot you. You may try to shoot me first if you can. You have that choice, and no other. Now decide." His mouth fell open and the key dropped from his hand. "Get out of my way," she said. He shook his head frantically, pressing his back against the door.
"Oh, Christ, ma'am," he gulped in the whine of a desperate plea. "I can't shoot at you, seeing as you come from Mr. Thompson. And I can't let you in against the word of Dr. Ferris. What am I to do? I'm only a little fellow. I'm only obeying orders. It's not up to me."
"It's your life," she said.
"If you let me ask the chief, he'll tell me."
"I won't let you ask anyone."
"But how do I know that you really have an order from Mr. Thompson?"
"You don't. Maybe I haven't. Maybe I'm acting on my own and you'll be punished for obeying me. Maybe I have, and you'll be thrown in jail for disobeying. Maybe Dr. Ferris and Mr. Thompson agree about this. Maybe they don't. And you have to defy one or the other. These are the things you have to decide. There is no one to ask, no one to call, no one to tell you. You will have to decide them yourself."
"But I can't decide. Why me?"
"Because it's your body that's barring my way."
"But I can't decide. I'm not supposed to decide."
"I'll count to three," she said. "Then I'll shoot."
Wait, I haven't said yes or no,"
he cried, cringing tighter against the door as if immobility of mind and body were his best protection. "One," she counted. She could see his eyes staring at her in terror. "Two." She could see that the gun held less terror for him than the alternative she offered. "Three." Calmly and impersonally, she, who would have hesitated to fire at an animal, pulled the trigger and fired straight at the heart of a man who had wanted to exist without the responsibility of consciousness. Her gun was equipped with a silencer. There was no sound to attract anyone's attention, only the thud of a body falling at her feet. She picked up the key from the ground, then waited for a few brief moments, as had been agreed upon. Francisco was first to join her, coming from behind a corner of the building, then Hank Reardon, then Ranyar Daneschult. There had been four guards posted at intervals among the trees around the building. They were now disposed of. One was dead, three were left in the brush, bound and gagged. She handed the key to Francisco without a word. He unlocked the door and went in alone, leaving the door open to the width of an inch. The three others waited outside by that opening. The hall was lighted by a single naked bulb stuck in the middle of the ceiling. A guard stood at the foot of the stairs leading to the second floor.
"Who are you?" he cried at the sight of Francisco entering as if he owned the place. "Nobody's supposed to come in here tonight."
"I did," said Francisco.
"Why did Rusty let you in?"
"He must have had his reasons."
"He wasn't supposed to."
"Somebody has changed your suppositions."
Francisco's eyes were taking a lightning inventory of the place. A second guard stood on the landing at the turn of the stairs, looking down at them and listening.
"What's your business?"
"Copper mining."
"Huh?" I mean, who are you?
The name's too long to tell you. I'll tell it to your chief. Where is he?
I'm asking the questions.
But he backed a step away.
Don't you act like a big shot, or I'll...
Hey, Pete!
He is, cried the second guard, paralyzed by Francisco's manner. The first one was struggling to ignore it. His voice grew louder with the growth of his fear as he snapped at Francisco.
What are you after?
I said I'll tell it to your chief. Where is he?
I'm asking the questions.
I'm not answering them.
Oh, you're not, are you?
Snarled Pete, who had but one recourse when in doubt. His hand jerked to the gun on his hip. Francisco's hand was too fast for the two men to see its motion, and his gun was too silent. What they saw and heard next was the gun flying out of Pete's hand, along with the splatter of blood from his shattered fingers and his muffled howl of pain. He collapsed, groaning. In the instant when the second guard grasped it, he saw that Francisco's gun was aimed at him.
"Don't shoot, mister," he cried.
"Come down here with your hands up," ordered Francisco, holding his gun aimed with one hand and waving a signal to the crack of the door with the other. By the time the guard descended the stairs, Reardon was there to disarm him, and Donnischild to tie his hands and feet. The sight of Dagny seemed to frighten him more than the rest. He could not understand it. The three men wore caps and windbreakers, and but for their manner could be taken for a gang of highwaymen. The presence of a lady was inexplicable. "Now," said Francisco, "where is your chief?" The guard jerked his head in the direction of the stairs.
"Up there.
How many guards are there in the building?"
"Nine.
Where are they?"
"One's on the cellar stairs. The others are all up there."
"Where?"
"In the big laboratory. The one with the window."
"All of them?"
"Yes."
"What are these rooms?" He pointed at the doors leading off the hall.
"They're labs, too. They're locked for the night.
Who's got the key?"
"Him."
He jerked his head at Pete. Reardon and Donnischild took the key from Pete's pocket and hurried soundlessly to check the rooms while Francisco continued. "Are there any other men in the building?"
"No."
"Isn't there a prisoner here?"
"Oh, yeah, I guess so. There must be, or they wouldn't have kept us all on duty."
"Is he still here?"
"That I don't know. They'd never tell us."
"Is Dr. Ferris here?"
"No, he left 10-15 minutes ago."
"Now that laboratory upstairs, does it open right on the stair landing?"
"Yes."
"How many doors are there?"
"Three. It's the one in the middle."
"What are the other rooms?"
"There's the small laboratory on one side and Dr. Ferris's office on the other."
"Are there connecting doors between them?"
"Yes."
Francisco was turning to his companions when the guard said pleadingly,
"Mister, can I ask you a question?"
"Go ahead."
"Who are you?"
He answered in the solemn tone of a drawing room introduction. "Francisco Domingo Carlos Andres Sebastian D'Anconia." He left the guard gaping at him and turned to a brief whispered consultation with his companions. In a moment it was Reardon who went up the stairs, swiftly, soundlessly, and alone. Cages containing rats and guinea pigs were stacked against the walls of the laboratory. They had been put there by the guards who were playing poker on the long laboratory table in the center. Six of them were playing. Two were standing in opposite corners watching the entrance door, guns in hand. It was Reardon's face that saved him from being shot on sight when he entered. His face was too well known to them and too unexpected. He saw eight heads staring at him with recognition, and with inability to believe what they were recognizing. He stood at the door, his hands in the pockets of his trousers, with the casual, confident manner of a business executive.
"Who is in charge here?"
he asked, in the politely abrupt voice of a man who does not waste time.
"You."
"You're not," stammered a lanky, surly individual at the card table.
"I'm Hank Reardon. Are you the chief?"
"Yeah, but where in blazes do you come from?"
"From New York. What are you doing here?" "Then I take it you have not been notified."
"Should I have? I mean, about what?"
The swift, touchy, resentful suspicion that his superiors had slighted his authority was obvious in the chief's voice. He was a tall, emaciated man with jerky movements, a sallow face, and the restless, unfocused eyes of a drug addict.
"About my business here."
You can't have any business here,"
he snapped, torn between the fear of a bluff and the fear of having been left out of some important top-level decision.
"Aren't you a traitor and a deserter and a—"
"I see that you're behind the times, my good man."
The seven others in the room were staring at Reardon with an awed, superstitious uncertainty. The two who held guns still held them aimed at him in the impassive manner of automatons. He did not seem to take notice of them.
"What is it you say is your business here?" snapped the chief. "I'm here to take charge of the prisoner whom you are to deliver to me. If you came from headquarters, you'd know that I'm not supposed to know anything about any prisoner, and that nobody is to touch him, except me."
She looked ahead. The earth would be as empty as the space where their propeller was cutting an unobstructed path. As empty and as free. She knew what Nat Taggart had felt at his start, and why now for the first time she was following him in full loyalty. The confident sense of facing a void and of knowing that one has a continent to build. She felt the whole struggle of her past rising before her and dropping away, leaving her here on the height of this moment. She smiled, and the words in her mind appraising and sealing the past were the words of courage, pride, and dedication, which most men had never understood, the words of a businessman's language. Price, no object. She did not gasp, and she felt no tremor when, in the darkness below, she saw a small string of lighted dots struggling slowly westward through the void, with the long bright dash of a headlight groping to protect the safety of its way. She felt nothing, even though it was a train, and she knew that it had no destination but the void. She turned to Galt. He was watching her face as if he had been following her thoughts. She saw the reflection of her smile in his. "It's the end," she said. "It's the beginning," he answered. Then they lay still, leaning back in their chairs, silently looking at each other. Then their persons filled each other's awareness as the sum and meaning of the future. But the sum included the knowledge of all that it had to be earned before the person of another being could come to embody the value of one's existence. New York was far behind them when they heard Donnerschild answer a call from the radio. "Yes, he's awake. I don't think he'll sleep tonight." "Yes, I think he can." He turned to glance over his shoulder. "John, Dr. Axton would like to speak to you." "What? Is he on one of those planes behind us?" "Certainly." Galt leaped forward to seize the microphone. "Hello, Dr. Axton," he said. The quiet, low tone of his voice was the audible image of a smile transmitted through space. "Hello, John." The too conscious steadiness of Hugh Axton's voice confessed at what cost he had waited to learn whether he would ever pronounce those two words again. "I just wanted to hear your voice, just to know that you're all right." Galt chuckled, and, in the tone of a student proudly presenting a completed task of homework as proof of a lesson well learned, he answered, "Of course I'm all right, Professor. I had to be. A is A." The locomotive of the eastbound comet broke down in the middle of a desert in Arizona. It stopped abruptly for no visible reason, like a man who had not permitted himself to know that he was bearing too much. Some overstrained connections snapped for good. When Eddie Willers called for the conductor, he waited a long time before the man came in, and he sensed the answer to his question by the look of resignation on the man's face. "The engineer is trying to find out what's wrong, Mr. Willers," he answered softly, in a tone implying that it was his duty to hope, but that he had held no hope for years. "He doesn't know? He's working on it." The conductor waited for a polite half minute and turned to go, but stopped to volunteer an explanation, as if some dim rational habit told him that any attempt to explain made any unadmitted terror easier to bear. "Those diesels of ours aren't fit to be sent out on the road, Mr. Willers. They weren't worth repairing long ago." "I know," said Eddie Willers quietly. The conductor sensed that his explanation was worse than none. It led to questions that men did not ask these days. He shook his head and went out. Eddie Willers sat looking at the empty darkness beyond the window. This was the first eastbound comet out of San Francisco in many days. She was the child of his tortured effort to reestablish transcontinental service. He could not tell what the past few days had cost him, or what he had done to save the San Francisco terminal from the blind chaos of a civil war that men were fighting with no concept of their goals. There was no way to remember the deals he had made on the basis of the range of every shifting moment. He knew only that he had obtained immunity for the terminal from the leaders of three different warring factions, that he had found a man for the post of terminal manager who did not seem to have given up altogether, that he had started one more Taggart Comet on her eastward run with the best diesel engine and the best crew available, and that he had boarded her for his return journey to New York with no knowledge of how long his achievement would last. He had never worked so hard. He had done his job as conscientiously well as he had always done any assignment, but it was as if he had worked in a vacuum, as if his energy had found no transmitters and had run into the sands of some such desert as the one beyond the window of the comet. He shuddered. He felt a moment's kinship with the stalled engine of the train. After a while, he summoned the conductor once more. "How is it going?" he asked. The conductor shrugged and shook his head. "Send the fireman to a track phone. Have him tell the division headquarters to send us the best mechanic available."
"Yes, sir."
There was nothing to see beyond the windows. Turning off the light, Eddie Willers could distinguish a gray spread dotted by the black spots of cacti, with no start to it and no end. He wondered how men had ever ventured to cross it, and at what price, in the days when there were no trains. He jerked his head away and snapped on the light. It was only the fact that the comet was in exile, he thought, that gave him this sense of pressing anxiety. She was stalled on an alien rail, on the borrowed track of the Atlantic Southern that ran through Arizona, the track they were using without payment. He had to get her out of here, he thought. He would not feel like this once they returned to their own rail. But the junction suddenly seemed an insurmountable distance away, on the shore of the Mississippi, at the Taggart Bridge. No, he thought. That was not all. He had to admit to himself what images were nagging him with a sense of uneasiness he could neither grasp nor dispel. They were too meaningless to define, and too inexplicable to dismiss. One was the image of a way station they had passed without stopping more than 2 hours ago. He had noticed the empty platform and the brightly lighted windows of the small station building. The lights came from empty rooms. He had seen no single human figure, neither in the building nor on the tracks outside. The other image was of the next way station they had passed. Its platform was jammed with an agitated mob. Now they were far beyond the reach of the light or sound of any station. He had to get the comet out of here, he thought. He wondered why he felt it with such urgency, and why it had seemed so crucially important to reestablish the comet's run. A mere handful of passengers was rattling in her empty cars. Men had no place to go and no goals to reach. It was not for their sake that he had struggled. He could not say for whose. Two phrases stood as the answer in his mind, driving him with the vagueness of a prayer and the scalding force of an absolute. One was, "From ocean to ocean forever." The other was, "Don't let it go." The conductor returned an hour later with the fireman, whose face looked oddly grim. "Mr. Willers," said the fireman slowly, "division headquarters does not answer." Eddie Willers sat up, his mind refusing to believe it, yet knowing suddenly that for some inexplicable reason this was what he had expected. "It's impossible," he said, his voice low. The fireman was looking at him, not moving. "The track phone must have been out of order." "No, Mr. Willers, it was not out of order. The line was live all right. The division headquarters wasn't. I mean, there was no one there to answer, or else no one who cared to." "But you know that that's impossible." The fireman shrugged. Men did not consider any disaster impossible these days. Eddie Willers leaped to his feet. "Go down the length of the train," he ordered the conductor. "Knock on all the doors, the occupied ones, that is, and see whether there's an electrical engineer aboard."
"Yes, sir."
Eddie knew that they felt as he felt it, that they would find no such man, not among the lethargic, extinguished faces of the passengers they had seen. "Come on," he ordered, turning to the fireman. They climbed together aboard the locomotive. The gray-haired engineer was sitting in his chair, staring out at the cacti. The engine's headlight had stayed on, and it stretched out into the night, motionless and straight, reaching nothing but the dissolving blur of cross ties.
Let's try to find what's wrong, said Eddie, removing his coat, his voice half order, half plea. Let's try some more.
Yes, sir, said the engineer, without resentment or hope.
The engineer had exhausted his meager store of knowledge. He had checked every source of trouble he could think of. He went crawling over and under the machinery, unscrewing its parts and screwing them back again, taking out pieces and replacing them, dismembering the motors at random like a child taking a clock apart, but without the child's conviction that knowledge is possible. The fireman kept leaning out of the cab's window, glancing at the black stillness and shivering, as if from the night air that was growing colder.
Don't worry, said Eddie Willers, assuming a tone of confidence. We've got to do our best, but if we fail, they'll send us help sooner or later. They don't abandon trains in the middle of nowhere.
They didn't used to, said the fireman. Once in a while, the engineer raised his grease-smeared face to look at the grease-smeared face and shirt of Eddie Willers.
What's the use, Mr. Willers? He asked.
We can't let it go, Eddie answered fiercely. He knew dimly that what he meant was more than the comet, and more than the railroad. Moving from the cab through the three motor units and back to the cab again, his hands bleeding, his shirt sticking to his back, Eddie Willers was struggling to remember everything he had ever known about engines, anything he had learned in college and earlier, anything he had picked up in those days when the station agents at Rockdale Station used to chase him off the rungs of their lumbering switch engines. The pieces connected to nothing. His brain seemed jammed and tight. He knew that motors were not his profession. He knew that he did not know, and that it was now a matter of life or death for him to discover the knowledge. He was looking at the cylinders, the blades, the wires, the control panels still winking with lights. He was struggling not to allow into his mind the thought that was pressing against its periphery. What were the chances, and how long would it take, according to the mathematical theory of probability, for primitive men working by rule of thumb to hit the right combination of parts and recreate the motor of this engine?
What's the use, Mr. Willers? Moaned the engineer. We can't let it go, he cried.
He did not know how many hours had passed when he heard the fireman shout suddenly, Mr. Willers, look! The fireman was leaning out the window, pointing into the darkness behind them. Eddie Willers looked. An odd little light was swinging jerkily far in the distance. It seemed to be advancing at an imperceptible rate. It did not look like any sort of light he could identify. After a while, it seemed to him that he distinguished some large black shapes advancing slowly, that they were moving in a line parallel with the track. The spot of light hung low over the ground, swinging. He strained his ears, but heard nothing. Then he caught a feeble, muffled beat that sounded like the hoofs of horses. The two men beside him were watching the black shapes with a look of growing terror, as if some supernatural apparition were advancing upon them out of the desert night. In the moment when they chuckled suddenly, joyously recognizing the shapes, it was Eddie's face that froze into a look of terror at the sight of a ghost more frightening than any they could have expected. It was a train of covered wagons. The swinging lantern jerked to a stop by the side of the engine.
Hey, bud, can I give you a lift? Called a man who seemed to be the leader.
He was chuckling.
Stuck, aren't you?
The passengers of the Comet were peering out of the windows. Some were descending the steps and approaching. Women's faces peeked from the wagons, from among the piles of household goods. A baby wailed somewhere at the rear of the caravan.
Are you crazy? Asked Eddie Willers.
No, I mean it, brother. We've got plenty of room. We'll give you folks a lift, for a price, if you want to get out of here.
He was a lanky, nervous man, with loose gestures and an insolent voice who looked like a sideshow barker. This is the Taggart Comet, said Eddie Willers, choking.
The Comet, eh? Looks more like a dead caterpillar to me. What's the matter, brother? You're not going anywhere. And you can't get there anymore, even if you tried.
What do you mean?
You don't think you're going to New York, do you?
We are going to New York.
Then you haven't heard?
What?
Say, when was the last time you spoke to any of your stations?
I don't know. Heard what?
That your Tiger Bridge is gone. Gone, blasted to bits. Sound ray explosion or something. Nobody knows exactly. Only there ain't any bridge anymore to cross the Mississippi. There ain't any New York anymore, leastways not for folks like you and me to reach.
Eddie Willers did not know what happened next. He had fallen back against the side of the engineer's chair, staring at the open door of the motor unit. He did not know how long he stayed there, but when at last he turned his head, he saw that he was alone. The engineer and the fireman had left the cab. There was a scramble of voices outside, screams, sobs, shouted questions, and the sound of the sideshow barker's laughter. Eddie pulled himself to the window of the cab. The Comet's passengers and crew were crowding around the leader of the caravan and his semi-ragged companions. He was waving his loose arms in gestures of command. Some of the better-dressed ladies from the Comet, whose husbands had apparently been first to make a deal, were climbing aboard the covered wagons, sobbing and clutching their delicate makeup cases.
"Step right up, folks! Step right up!" the barker was yelling cheerfully. "We'll make room for everybody. A bit crowded, but moving. Better than being left here for coyote fodder. The day the iron horse is past. All we got is plain old-fashioned horse, slow but sure."
Eddie Willers climbed halfway down the ladder on the side of the engine to see the crowd and to be heard. He waved one arm, hanging onto the rungs with the other.
"You're not going, are you?" he cried to his passengers. "You're not abandoning the Comet?"
They drew a little away from him, as if they did not want to look at him or answer. They did not want to hear questions their minds were incapable of weighing. He saw the blind faces of panic.
"What's the matter with the grease monkey?" asked the barker, pointing at Eddie.
"Mr. Willers," said the conductor softly, "it's no use."
"Don't abandon the Comet," cried Eddie Willers. "Don't let it go."
"Oh, God, don't let it go." "Are you crazy?" cried the barker. "You've no idea what's going on at your railroad stations and headquarters. They're running around like a pack of chickens with their heads cut off. I don't think there's going to be a railroad left in business this side of the Mississippi by tomorrow morning."
"Better come along, Mr. Willers," said the conductor.
"No," cried Eddie, clutching the metal rung as if he wanted his hand to grow fast to it. The barker shrugged.
"Well, it's your funeral."
"Which way are you going?" asked the engineer, not looking at Eddie.
"Just going, brother. Just looking for some place to stop, somewhere. We're from Imperial Valley, California. The People's Party crowd grabbed the crops and any food we had in the cellars. Hoarding, they called it. So we just picked up and went. Got to travel by night on account of the Washington crowd. We're just looking for some place to live. You're welcome to come along, buddy, if you got no home. Or else we can drop you off close to some town or another."
The men of that caravan, thought Eddie indifferently, looked too mean-minded to become the founders of a secret free settlement, and not mean-minded enough to become a gang of raiders. They had no more destination to find than the motionless beam of the headlight, and like that beam, they would dissolve somewhere in the empty stretches of the country. He stayed on the ladder looking up at the beam. He did not watch while the last men, ever to ride the Taggart Comet, were transferred to the covered wagons. The conductor went last.
"Mr. Willers,"
he called desperately,
"come along."
"No," said Eddie. The sideshow barker waved his arm in an upward sweep at Eddie's figure on the side of the engine above their heads.
"I hope you know what you're doing,"
he cried, his voice half threat, half plea.
"Maybe somebody will come this way to pick you up. Next week or next month. Maybe. Who's going to these days?"
"Get away from here," said Eddie Willers.
He climbed back into the cab. When the wagons jerked forward and went swaying and creaking off into the night, he sat in the engineer's chair of a motionless engine, his forehead pressed to the useless throttle. He felt like the captain of an ocean liner in distress who preferred to go down with his ship rather than be saved by the canoe of savages taunting him with the superiority of their craft. Then, suddenly, he felt the blinding surge of a desperate, righteous anger. He leaped to his feet, seizing the throttle. He had to start this train. In the name of some victory that he could not name, he had to start the engine moving. Past the stage of thinking, calculation, or fear, moved by some righteous defiance, he was pulling levers at random. He was jerking the throttle back and forth. He was stepping on the dead man's pedal, which was dead. He was groping to distinguish the form of some vision that seemed both distant and close, knowing only that his desperate battle was fed by that vision and was fought for its sake. "Don't let it go," his mind was crying, while he was seeing the streets of New York. "Don't let it go," while he was seeing the lights of railroad signals. "Don't let it go." while he was seeing the smoke rising proudly from factory chimneys, while he was struggling to cut through the smoke and reach the vision at the root of these visions.